My name is John. I'm an alcoholic, and I've heard great things about this group. Charlie talks about you all a lot, very affectionately, at some of the other meetings that I attend. So I was honored when he asked me to be a leadoff speaker today. Charlie is my sponsor, if you don't haven't already figured that part out. And I begged Charlie to take me on when I found out that he was somebody who was more of a free thinker and would indulge my interests and my weird ideas about what a higher power might be, and incorporating that with Buddhism and Stoicism and just things that either of us read in various things. So lately, I think I've been boring him with quantum entanglement. So I'll have to torture him some more about that some other time. That's getting pretty heady stuff. So anyway, I should start off by telling you, oh, good afternoon, by the way. I just looked it up. It's 3:05 in Ireland, I think. I have a special affinity for the people of Ireland dating back to about the mid-1970s. I was a teenager, about 14, 15 years old, living in the Netherlands with my family in The Hague, or Den Haag, as they say in Dutch. About that age, as I recall, I had my first girlfriend. And my dad made this rule that I had to be home by 9 p.m. on school nights. Ridiculous, right? That's what I thought. To my mind, that seemed unfair, intolerable, oppressive, and just I just didn't know how I could deal with that. So, and I was particularly onerous because I was a good student and, you know, otherwise wasn't causing them any problems, but I thought I should be able to hang out later at night. So anyway, being in the midst of my rebellious years, I packed up my backpack and slipped out in the middle of the night, hopped on my 10 speed, and off I went. And that led me to about a week-long adventure that took me across the English Channel into England, and then from there to made my way to Liverpool by train, and from Liverpool across the Irish Sea to Belfast. And that's where I kind of settled in for a little while. I started meeting people easily because all I had to do was ask where the restroom was or ask if they could point me to the hostel. And as soon as they heard my American accent, people were fascinated and stopping me in the streets, wanting my opinion on all kinds of things I had no business having an opinion on, like the Vietnam War at the time. But anyway, it was easy to strike up a conversation, easy to get to know people. And I was embraced and taken in by one particular Irish family that I really grew close to. So they kind of semi-adopted me, and I survived on coal cannon. Hopefully I'm saying that right. Corned beef, Dublin coddle, all kinds of things I'd never heard of, including this wonderful beverage called Guinness. So between corned beef and Guinness and everything else, I and this wonderful family that hosted me, I was having a great time. I wasn't planning on going much of anywhere. So Maggie, the matron of the family, over time convinced me that I should at least contact my mother and let her know I was okay and where I was. And she'd had little snippets of that I was okay by me staying in contact with my girlfriend. But by the time I did finally reach out to her, that poor woman had probably aged about 10 years in a matter of 2 weeks. So I felt bad about that. But we began talking and I very immature brain at that point. So I was just trying to assert myself at a premature age and so forth. And eventually we agreed that I would come back home if I didn't get punished for running away, which if you're a parent, you know, they're going to find a way to punish you, even if it's not for running away. So I paid my dues in all kinds of different other ways, but nonetheless got back home. And my mom was terrified that I'd probably run away again, which I might have now that I'd done it and had such a great time. So she had the foresight to come up with a solution. And that is that there was an acting company out of New York City that was putting together a troupe a production troupe of actors and actresses and so forth that would be touring all over Europe for about 6 months. And so she flew me to New York City and I tried out, and miraculously I made it. So I spent the next 6 months, I was far enough ahead in school that it didn't affect that, but spent the next 6 months trying my hand at acting and just had a great time. We got to see a whole lot more of Europe than I'd ever seen before, and had a wonderful time. And it kept her in contact with knowing where I was and that I was safe. So it was kind of a nice, clever solution at the time. So anyway, that 3 week or so stint that I had on traveling around by bicycle, tram, train, ferry across the English Channel, ferry across the Irish Sea, and so forth. It kind of brought, thinking back about it, kind of brought out probably my two most toxic character faults, and those are pride and arrogance. And it brought those together, and they were happily married with a pint of Guinness. So I think the seeds of alcoholism were probably planted at that age. I didn't really become a problem with alcohol until later in my life. But looking back on it, that's the character traits were there, and kind of the setup was there. So in any case, I went on to excel in high school and did pretty well there. Went to college and did well there. I always liked academics, so that was not a labor for me. It was something I enjoyed. And then eventually made my way back to Colorado for medical school and graduated from that. And then there's several more years of training, internship and residency and fellowship and so forth. So along about the time of my 15th high school reunion, I finally had an active job other than just being a full-time student. But anyway, I ended up doing academics for a couple of years and then going into private practice, where things got real busy real quick. And sometime during residency and then going into my practice years, I began using alcohol medicinally. So I wouldn't really drink at parties or around other people. I would just drink as a way of shutting my mind down at the end of a busy day. So that way I could study all the way up till, if I wanted to go to bed at 11, if I wanted to study until 10:45, I could just, you know, drink a couple of beers real quick, calm my mind down and go to sleep. So I thought that was a pretty decent solution at the time. And then that continued even more so into practice, as you just get busier and busier and your mind's always on. So I just use that as a way of assisting my mind to shut off. And that kind of became a problem, as I'll also go into later in life, as problems began to mount. I was married for 17 years to my first wife. We had two wonderful daughters whom I'm exceptionally close to. And my ex-wife and I get along great. We co-parent, even though our kids are in their 30s now, we still have a really good relationship and continue to co-parent our daughters. So jumping forward to around 2013, 2014, I had a couple of really bad years, and there were several things that kind of came together to make a perfect storm. One is that I was going through a divorce from my second wife that was extremely stressful, and that whole marriage was a huge mistake, but it was a very, very stressful and contentious divorce. And secondly, I had built a practice that of four physicians, myself and three others, and the other three started getting picked off a little bit, one by the hospital, and one joined another practice, and another one wanted to go out on their own. And so they kind of started disappearing one by one. And I had invested a lot of money in an office, so my overhead started going up because there just wasn't as many people to pay it. So I could handle that. That was not the end of the world, but it just was one more item on my plate. And then in November of 2013, I think I was visiting my daughter in Colorado for Thanksgiving. Let me wet my whistle here. And I'm from Colorado, so it seemed really odd to me that I was so short of breath. Just walking down the hallway at the hotel, pulling one of those roller bags, and by the time I get to the elevator, I'd be ready to sit down and catch my breath. I couldn't really figure out what was going on. But made an appointment to see my primary care doc shortly after I got back home. And my hemoglobin was 6.7, I think, which is, to translate that, that means about half the blood in my body was missing. It had gone elsewhere. So turns out I got scoped, because that's one of the more common places people lose blood. And I had an ulcer in my stomach that had been recently bleeding. So made perfect sense. So I had a lot of stress. the ulcer caused me to lose blood, made me short of breath. It seemed like it was an open and shut case. So I was put on medication by my gastroenterologist, and I thought that was pretty much the end of that. But about 3 days later, he calls the office, and I came to the phone, and normally when a doctor calls a doctor, it's about, hey, I've got a patient I want you to see. Let me tell you a little bit about him and that sort of thing. And I was expecting to be that kind of phone call, but he started off by saying that the biopsy came back positive for cancer. And I don't know if you all know who Charlie Brown is, but it's a cartoon. And usually when his teacher or his parent is talking, all Charlie Brown hears is wah, 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 wah. And that's kind of all the rest of that conversation just went way over my head. I didn't pick up anything he said. So I had to call him back at the end of the day and apologize and ask him to go over it again. So that led to, a lot of real busy month or two ahead of doing staging workup and seeing an oncologist and figuring out what we were going to do about it. And ultimately, they came up with a plan, which was to resect the malignancy, remove it. I was thought to be a stage 2B at the time, which is kind of a medium level as far as cancer goes. So the plan was made to do a resection and remove my lymph nodes and probably follow that with chemotherapy or radiation therapy or both, depending upon what the pathology showed. So we made plans to start that in motion. And in January of that next year, I underwent a gastrectomy, and they removed about 2/3 of my stomach, which made eating and drinking kind of interesting. We had to kind of do that pretty slow. So that was a big surgery to recovery from, and based upon the number of lymph nodes that were positive, I was changed to a stage 3C, which is, that's getting into about the 50-50 survival range there. So that kind of put me into a group where I just wasn't really sure what the outcome was going to be. I was sure as heck going to fight to stay alive. So I did everything I was supposed to do, completed chemo and radiation over the next year, and thankfully continued to have negative scopes and negative scans. And at this point, I'm considered in permanent long-term remission. It should not come back unless I just have particularly bad luck. So between all those things going on, the malignancy with the understanding I had a 50-50 chance of survival, my partners being picked off and going various places, which put me under a little bit of financial strain, and then the divorce, which was still ongoing at that time, things were piling up pretty heavy, and I was turning to alcohol again to sleep. I wasn't a drinker that would drink around other people or, wanted to be around other people when I drank. I just wanted to drink a whole lot real fast and then knock myself out. So that continued. I remember still being in a lazy chair, recovering from my surgery, because I really couldn't hardly stand up without help. And I managed to sneak a bottle of vodka next to the chair so I could drink myself to sleep. So obviously I had a problem. There's no question there when you had 2/3 of your stomach cut out and you're filling the other third of it with vodka. So, so that's when I kind of began to realize, this just isn't right. And as I realized I was going to survive the cancer, I became even more motivated to look at my whole life and at my physical self, especially, and my spiritual self. But I needed to go back into survival mode, not just survival mode, but I needed to fix a lot of things that were still lingering that could cause me problems down the road. So I kind of started a plan to do that. And it wasn't a particularly good plan, because all I knew is I needed to quit, but I didn't really know how. And I'd heard about this thing called AA. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty good. I'll give them a try. So in the meantime, I somewhere in there, I remarried to my third wife, who was just wonderful. So I had a great relationship behind me, had, definitely motivated to take better care of myself. And things seemed like they were turning the corner and going pretty well. So I started attending meetings, but I just never really latched on. I would go and I would listen. And the typical meeting was we would introduce ourselves, and then the facilitator would say, well, let's turn to page 136 of the big book or whatever, and we'll go around and just read. So we'd spend about another 30-40 minutes just taking turns reading, and then you know, we close it up with a prayer, and that was pretty much what the meetings were. And that's not anybody's fault. It's just I needed to go to more meetings and find ones that I was getting more help with. So I was kind of in and out, you know, one toe in, one toe out. My wife was very encouraging, and she started going to Al-Anon with me. We try to set up meetings together. So she was very supportive, and I really appreciated that. I did get a sponsor, a great guy like Charlie, that I watched, sat back and watched and picked after a while and said, this is the guy that he has what I want. That's the guy I want to be like. And he had been 30, 40 years sober, older fellow, and just a real great down to earth guy. So we kind of started to get to know each other. And then unfortunately he was diagnosed with cancer. So his health started to tank, and I kind of became part of his support team, which I was more than happy to do. He's a wonderful person and didn't really have any family around. So I would take him to his appointments, and we'd spend a lot of time going over his treatment and things like that. So in other words, we never really established much of a sponsor type relationship. It was kind of mutually beneficial, but it certainly didn't work as far as somebody needing to, you know, to walk me through the process or encourage me to do the things that I needed to do. So in other words, long story short, I just never really got attached to AA. I would go through the motions. I'd go to some meetings. But nothing really hooked. Nothing really, really worked for me. And I'd go through periods of abstinence of maybe 2 weeks, I think maybe 4 weeks one time, but it was clearly, I was just not committed to the long-term solution there. So this went on for a while. And in the midst of that, I retired at the end of 2016. I kind of took an early retirement. And this was part of my life's plan. I'm a private pilot. I fly small planes. And so my plan was, I'll go back to Alaska where I'm from. I'll take some of the bush pilot training courses. That's where you do the nasty stuff like landing on riverbeds and gravel roads and farms and water takeoffs and water landings and fun stuff like that. So I was going to beef up my piloting skills and then work for the Alaska Native Health Association for the rest of my life. That was my plan, just flying myself and a nurse and maybe a paramedic into these tiny little villages and drawing blood and taking blood pressures and trying to explain to them why whale blubber was not good for their cholesterol while being chased with a harpoon back onto the plane. So that's how I envisioned spending the rest of my life. But my wife in the meantime was becoming progressively more ill. I knew she had a congenital disorder. We talked about it early on when we started dating, and it was it's a mitochondrial disorder. Basically, the mitochondria are like the battery packs for your cells. Every cell in your body just about has a mitochondria, which is what powers it. And she had a mitochondrial disorder, which could affect any part of her body at any point in time. Well, she had been really, really healthy. In fact, when we met, she was playing tennis 5 days a week competitively, working two jobs, just super healthy, super active. But for whatever reason, this disease decided to start dragging her down. And that it did. So she was getting multiple medical problems from it. And where we lived in Alaska, there really aren't very many specialists. And so they're prone to sending you to fly down to Seattle if you really need to see a high-level specialist. So after a few trips back and forth to Seattle and seeing that things were not going to just quickly turn around on, we talked about it, and I made the decision that we needed to come back down to the lower 48. It's what Americans call the main part of the U.S. So we decided we should come back down to the lower 48, and I was already licensed in Kentucky, so that was an easy fit, and I found a great job here. So we kind of, we still had our home in Alaska, but we came back down here to get better medical care for her. So her health, unfortunately, continued to tank pretty quickly. She became about 90% blind. She had just a little sliver, a moon-shaped sliver of vision in one eye, and that was it. And then dementia set in, and along with that, hallucinations. And she was only 55 when she passed away. So these things were happening very rapidly and at a young age. But In the midst of that, of course, she needed more care, especially as she stopped being able to think clearly. So I hired an agency to be with her during the daytime, and then I would come home and relieve them, and I'd stay with her for the rest of the night, and I'd be her caretaker at night. Just 1 second. So, and honestly, it was an honor to do that. I can't imagine not having done that, and it was an honor. I some people ask if it, you know, if I had regrets or issues about, because I really had to give up the rest of my life. I would work and then come home. So there was no more fishing, no more hiking, no more traveling, no more flying planes, no more of the things that I used to love to do for recreation. But I loved being there for her, and I was proud to be able to do that for her. By this time, by the way, I was sober. I'd been to a rehab program in Las Vegas after having failed at my half-assed attempts at doing AA by myself. I'd been through a good rehab program and was well on track for being sober. I think I was sober for close to 3 years by the time that she started needing full-time care. So that kind of continued on. And as part of being the caretaker, I couldn't really let myself go to sleep all the way. So I would always kind of have, you know, one ear open and one eye kind of half open, and kind of learn to just go into just a more of a drowsiness state rather than letting myself fall asleep so that I could hear her, because I was afraid she was a very high risk for falling, and I didn't want her to get out of bed and fall. So I was always kind of hypervigilant to what was going on with her. And so this went on for some time. And I should also mention that unlike me, she was very religious. She was Catholic and had a lot of Catholic values. And so we would pray together every night, even though I'm not a believer in the Judeo-Christian concept of God necessarily. I was happy to pray with her. And basically for me, it just became a gratitude list. So my prayer would be, dear Heavenly Father, we have so many things to thank you for. We thank you for this home. We thank you for this roof that doesn't leak. We thank you for this, you know, this nice warm home that we live in, and these beds that we can sleep in, and this food, and our pets and our children. And, you know, I would just kind of run through everything I could think of on a gratitude list. And that would be, my prayer would be, you know, we hope that other people can be as fortunate as we are. So it was, even though I wasn't religious, it was nice. I enjoyed it because it was a gratitude list basically, and made me realize that my problems were not as big as I sometimes thought they were. So one morning I checked on her. I would sleep in a recliner across from her. And so one morning I kind of checked on her. We had an agreement that if she was already asleep, I would be really quiet not to wake her up. So I kind of tiptoed in, took my shower, got dressed for work, peeked in on her, made sure that she had a drink on her bedside stand and her medication on her bedside stand. And then traded off with the caretakers I was leaving for work. And 2.5 hours later, about 10:30 in the morning, I got a call from the caretaker saying that she was concerned that Kim had not woken up yet. So she went and checked on her, and she had passed away. And it was later determined by the coroner that it had probably occurred earlier in the night, sometime after midnight or so. With that, obviously I lost somebody who was really, really pivotal and important to me. And, I dealt with some guilt issues. One is that, that I always imagined that when she would pass away, that I'd be there, you know, holding her hand and talking to her. And, so I missed that opportunity, but, and then also, I just felt guilt because she had been telling me for a long time that she felt she was dying. She had wanted to sign up for hospice. And I kept saying, well, you know, I've been with you to every doctor's appointment, every hospital stay. I'm not seeing anything in your labs or on your tests that says you're imminently about to die. So, you know, when the time is right, we can do that. But I would kind of reassure her, and she would then, you know, say, nope, you're wrong. I'm going to pass away. So I had some guilt about that. guilt in both those instances, I realized makes no rational sense. I mean, I couldn't possibly plan to have been there when her heart stopped at 2 o'clock in the morning or whenever it did. And I couldn't possibly have said, okay, let's go hospice. Let's, you know, let's get him out here and we'll sign you up on the feeling that you're going to pass away. So I realize those are not rational, but nonetheless, guilt is guilt. It is what it is. So, and I have dealt with that. I've been through some grieving groups and so forth, and I think I've got that pretty well settled. But the part that didn't settle was the sleep. And as I mentioned, I'd always kept, you know, an ear up and an eye kind of half open, watching and listening for any movement. And even after she passed away, I continued to sleep like that. And I would frequently start to drift off, and then I would startle thinking that I heard my name. And it would take me only a second or two to realize, no, she's passed away. And then the same thing would happen multiple times per night, night after night after night. I just could not get sufficient sleep or sleep at all. And then one fateful day, the day of my big mistake, I hadn't slept in about 2 or 3 days. And I was in this sleep-deprived, stinking-thinking state that I was in. I decided I really needed some sleep in order to be able to do a good job at work the next day. And that was utterly important. It didn't occur to me that if I felt I couldn't do a good job, I could just call in, but that didn't cross my mind. But the fact that I needed sleep was foremost on my mind. And in the meantime, I tried various over-the-counter things and some prescription medications that were not helping me. So a light bulb went off and it said, I know what works. Half pint of vodka will take care of you. You'll sleep great if you just go get just a half pint. Don't buy anything bigger than that, just a half pint, because it's just a one-time thing. And you know, how many of us have heard that story so many times before? That critical mistake of thinking you don't have a disease. You're okay. You can drink once in a while. So that with that screwed up thinking, I went to the liquor store and bought a half pint of vodka, and sure enough, slept like a baby. Woke up the next morning, felt fantastic. Had a good day at work. And then on the way home the next night, I thought, you know, that worked so well. I think, you know, I'm not gonna take up drinking anymore, but I think that I should just keep a half pint on hand, you know, just in case I get into a real big bind like that. And there was a 3-day weekend coming up when the liquor stores were gonna be closed for 2 of those 3 days. So I thought, I should just go ahead and just have one on hand to, you know, just in case I get into a real bad bind like that again. And so you probably know where this is going. I mean, I was just circling the drain and getting ready to go right back down it again. So just as you've probably heard so many people say, half pint became a pint, became a whole lot more, became, you know, like a fourth of a fifth, and you know, excessive drinking just came back just like a freight train, just rolled over me. And I was just completely out of control, way more than I'd ever drunk before, in my quest to fall asleep and stay asleep. So this went on, and I knew I was getting into some trouble. But I just, as we say in step one, I couldn't control it. I had no control over it. So I was trying to manage it by myself, and I started combining alcohol with sleeping pills, thinking, okay, if I find the right sleeping pill and then I can, you know, wean myself off the vodka pretty quick, and then, you know, I'll be back to being okay again. Well, that mixture was a horrible idea, and I ended up falling and hitting my head. I have no recollection of it, but hitting my head bad enough to sustain a really horrible concussion one night. And then that ended up leading to a second fall about a week later. So I had concussion on top of concussion. And by that point, I couldn't even walk. I was so, my balance was so off. I couldn't think clearly. I thought I'd had a horrible brain injury. And I did end up being hospitalized on the trauma unit at University of Kentucky for a couple of days, because I did have a little bit of bleeding on the brain, just not much, but a little bit. But that just scared the dickens out of me. So I was, you know, I make my living by using my brain, as most of us do. And I just could not imagine life without being able to think clearly. So I was scared to death, and knew that I'd passed the point where I had to stop. So I quit, never touched it again. And this time when my thinking started to clear up, I thought, you know, I need some more help. I need somebody to keep an eye on me. And so I reached out to our state medical board and told them I had a problem and that I wanted to be enrolled in a program where I'd be monitored and, you know, random tests and all that sort of thing. So they were happy to accommodate that and sent me off to a 3-month rehab program, which was really good. And so I learned a lot about myself and a lot about the disease there and have continued to grow on that and implement that into my life. So I'm about a year and a half sober now, year and 5 months, I think. So I, you know, which seems like a tiny amount compared to many of you all, but it's a start. You know, you don't start off the race, the marathon at mile 13. You have to start at the beginning. So it's a race. And I have to tell you, I'm terrified of relapse. It scares the heck out of me because I keep hearing the numbers and the statistics. And I relapsed once and I relapsed so bad that I know there is no question in my mind that if I relapse again, it's going to kill me. I'm going to do something really awful and, you know, fall and break my neck or have a horrible head injury and that'll be the end of me. So that fear factor stays with me. And that's part of what motivates me. That, and I'm just enjoying the sober life. I'm enjoying having my head clear and being able to think clearly. I'm enjoying not having to worry about a hangover in the mornings, all those awful things that go with heavy drinking on a regular basis. So that's where I am at life. I'm happy. I'm healthy. I'm in another good relationship. And I feel like I'm getting physically, mentally, and spiritually stronger as each month goes by. So that's where I'm at. I appreciate having the opportunity to share. Thank you.